The sessions this afternoon were ALSEP results, physical properties, and mineralogy, petrology, and geology. And we've tried to get a representative sampling of some of the authors from each of those sessions. And we'll follow the same procedure as this morning, where each of the gentlemen will take up to 3 to 5 minutes to summarize the highlights of his paper. And then we'll open it up to questions. To my immediate left is Dr. Harold Urey of the University of California at San Diego, and Dr. Gary Latham of the Lamont-Doherty Geologic Observatory, Palisades, New York, Professor Thomas Gold of Cornell University, Dr. Edward Anderson of the University of Chicago, Edward Anders, and Dr. George H. Morrison, also of Cornell. And down on the end is Dr. William Eamon of the University of Kentucky. And if each of you gentlemen, unless there's some reason for going in some other order, if we could just start with Dr. Urey and proceed down the table, if you would tell what your session was and the title of your paper before starting.
My paper was a model for the history of the moon, wasn't it? Something like that. I've forgotten myself. Let me see here.
Here it is. Suggested model history of the moon.
Suggested model history of the moon. Well, the thing that has been worrying me for the years since the Apollo 11 meeting a year ago has been that, and before that, springs from several different bits of information which must be met simultaneously. The moon was heavily differentiated 4.5, 4.6 billion years ago by a melting process, no doubt about it all. Second, at the same time, mascons were somehow formed. They are very massive bodies. The one in Mare Imbrium could be estimated to be about 2 million billion tons. 2 million billion tons. It would make, if there is a 10% difference in density between the mascon and the surroundings, it would cover the state of California to a depth of about 11 kilometers, I think, which would be a very large lava flow on the Earth. I do not believe that you can have lava flows of that magnitude and at the same time support them. And I have consulted quite a number of my colleagues in geology and geophysics, and found no disagreement with that. Yet it is true that remelting of some material occurred 3.3 to 4.0 billion years ago. How do you manage to make all of these facts agree? And my proposal is that the melting process occurred on the surface of the moon by an external source of heat, and solidified rather quickly, followed by collisions which made a rubble of the surface of the moon and, of course, made it highly insulating to heat. And I think the remelting occurred by radioactive heating because of this highly insulating layer on the outside. The maximum amount of radioactivity would be present 4.6 billion years ago, and very much less, about 60% of it, would be left after a billion years later. So that we have a little problem there. What I'm trying to see is how to account for the support of the mascons, how to get the initial melting of the moon to produce the differentiation, and how to get a remelting process approximately a billion years later. And that is the sort of thing that I discussed. If there are any questions you want to ask, Bob, try to.
I think if we could, we'll pick up the questions after each of the people has made his presentation. Dr. Latham?
Well, nothing changed my mind since our last meeting that this is the most exciting business in the world to be in any place else. We have, in this past year, been able to derive enough data from the single station that's been operating and continues to operate without any sign of quitting, enough data to further refine some of the remarks we made earlier. We record an event that we can identify on the records about once every day, every 24 hours, a little less than that. Some of these events are produced by meteorite impacts, and some of them by internal mechanisms, that is, moon quakes. The meteorite impacts occur once, let me put it this way, about once per month we record an impact produced by a meteoroid the size, say, of a large grapefruit, which strikes somewhere within the Apollo 12 region within about 120 miles. Now, this rate is lower than most Earth-based estimates, or for that matter, satellite-based estimates. And in conjunction with the recent observations of the Surveyor 3 area, in which studies were made of the region disrupted or smoothed, say, by the footpad of the Surveyor 3, and compared with the television shots that Surveyor made at that time, if you remember the footpad depression, for example, and those that the astronauts took, there was a very, very careful study to see if there were any little craters produced in that interim, and there were none found. So that the evidence seems to begin to point toward fewer meteoroids striking the moon than we had previously estimated. As for the moon quakes, which make up most of the signals, they occur very strongly associated with times of the closest approach between the Earth and the moon, called perigee. These are times of maximum tidal stress. That is, the shape of the moon bulges toward the Earth to a maximum extent at those times, and there is stress introduced into the moon. And that stress is superimposed on internal stresses of unknown origin. And the combination produces a moonquake, that is, a sudden release of energy within the moon. Now, most of the activity is associated with one place on the moon. And we have tentatively located that place in or near the crater Fraumaro, which is about 120 miles away from the Apollo 12 station, and in the vicinity of a very well-developed set of rills, linear rills, that cut right across the crater. And, of course, these rills have been long a source of intrigue for scientists, just what they are. If our association of these moonquakes with rills is correct, then we are dealing with sudden slippage of one side of the rill relative to the other side. That means that these are faults. These are great cracks in the moon that are along which movements are presently taking place, rather than just ditches dug into the moon by erosional processes of some kind, by gas flow or what other mechanism has been proposed. And there are a particular kind of fault called a graben, which means that the middle of the ditch is settling down rather than getting lateral slip, because we see no evidence for lateral slip in these things. Now, what can be the source of these of this energy? Well, we believe that the moon is receding from the Earth at something like 3 centimeters per year, an inch per year or so, a little more. And gradually, the moon may be settling back into a more spherical shape as this recession takes place. When it was very close, the moon would have been bulging out toward the Earth, and as it moves away, it would slowly settle back into a more spherical shape. Another possibility is that the moon is cooling and contracting very, very slightly. Conversely, it may be heating and expanding, but very, very slightly. There are other possibilities that I won't go into now, but fact is, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this is exceedingly small amount of energy we're talking about. The energy per unit volume released in moonquakes, if the Apollo 12 region is typical, and we certainly can't say that it's typical yet, is 100 million times less than for the Earth. Factor of 10 to the 8th. So it's an exceedingly small amount of energy release we're talking about. And this leads me to question some the people who prefer rather warm interiors for the moon, where you would have temperatures, say, just below the melting point or even at the melting point in some models that I've seen proposed. Because you certainly have to have convection in those cases. Very hard to avoid. Even if it's below the melting point, you can get some convection. Convection on Earth is quite vigorous and, of course, leads to the deformations of the surface, the folded mountains and the great fractures that are produced, and earthquakes. And on the moon, you would expect a similar association. So if temperatures are high, I would say that the associated convection must be confined to very, very deep interior of the moon, and we must have overlying a very, very rigid and thick shell in order for this to occur, this moonquake activity to be so low in level, and for us not to see any evidence of folded mountains or other large-scale deformational features that are associated with convection currents on Earth. Well, the evidence, in my view, points toward a very stable internal situation, not one which allows for high temperatures at all, except perhaps at very great depths. Now, the magnetometer results we heard reported, I don't think we have a magnetometer man this morning, tended in that direction. That is, they predicted from their results low temperatures, although I think they would themselves admit that these are very, very preliminary data, and we can't make much out of it. Now, the one thing I would like to mention is that the so-called lunar transit events, which have been observed by astronomers for decades on the surface, the sudden bright flashes of light on the lunar surface, or in some cases colored glows, in other cases short-term obscurations of the surface where it suddenly appears that you're looking through a gas cloud. Also have been seen to occur at times of perigee and apogee, that is when the Earth and the Moon are closest together and then again when they're furthest apart. And many of us doubted the reality of these events. I know I did. But now I begin to wonder seriously about them and consider that they may well be related in their causative mechanism to earthquakes, to moonquakes. It may be that they really are gaseous emissions and that tidal strains produce openings along pre-existing weaknesses in the outer shell of the moon that gases may escape from. But in our attempt to find a direct correlation, we've so far not succeeded. That is, all lunar transient events reported from the area of Fomaro, I hope I have them all, and none of them have corresponded to the times of moonquakes. Nevertheless, it's a very intriguing problem, and one we hope to get more information on out of 14, where we'll have this very, very sensitive gas gauge directed toward this region, and if there are gaseous emissions, hopefully they will be recorded, and they will correspond, perhaps, with the occurrence of a moonquake.
Professor Gold is next. Professor Gold's paper was Physical Properties of the Apollo 12 Lunar Finds.
Yes, well, I only had to report the sort of bread and butter work of analyzing all the various physical properties, grain size, distribution, and comparing the two sites, Apollo 11 and 12, and comparing the different core samples for the grain size and appearance, the optical properties, reflectance of light, polarization of light, and the electrical properties, high-frequency electrical properties, dielectric constant, and dielectric loss, meaning those are the quantities of relevance for the radio reflection properties of the moon. Well, there the upshot of all this is that essentially there's great similarity between the 11 and 12 sites, but not quite identical in all these respects. There are observable differences between the two sites. On the other hand, the differences are rather small compared with what they would be if you went on the Earth to drastically different locations. Some very interesting conclusions. About the core sample, it is quite clear that the core, this 40 centimeter of core that was pushed into the ground and then lifted out, that core is clearly striated, layered. It is not a homogeneously mixed up stuff. It's individual layers, and from the bits of core that I had, I can at least say that the layers are less than 5 centimeters thick. But from the optical appearance of the core that I saw, it's clear that some of the layers are as little as 1 centimeter thick. So we are dealing... that structure of such layers shows itself in all the properties. Optical, grain size distribution, and I understand also in chemical properties. Now what that has to say is that we are certainly not dealing with what has been called the gardened regolith. That whole picture must be in error if this core is representative. Of course, you might say this was an isolated case and everywhere else the ground is well stirred over, just the particular place where the astronauts got their core is not. But on the other hand, the discussion of the turning over of the ground by impacts that we had, for example, a year ago, was that it would have been turned over to that depth 100 times since that material was deposited there. So then it is exceedingly unlikely that you go to one site and find it not even turned over once, if the average were 100 times. So it is quite clear that the gardening turning over effect must be essentially absent, for this site at least. But since we know that meteorites do fall at a somewhat slower rate than had been said before, but nevertheless it's a quite significant rate on a long time scale. Since we know that that happens, they undoubtedly turn over the ground. So the only way in which you can have it that you see ground that has not been mixed is that it has been depositing, that it's been filling in faster than the average digging rate by impacts. So it seems to me, I don't know that many people have yet discussed this point, so I don't know what the consensus of opinion is, but it seems to me quite clear that the striation in the core sample that we find indicates that we are here at least in a site, and if on the 12 site at least, in a place where the filling in process, where there is a filling in process, so of a gentle kind, so as to allow layers as thin as a few centimeters to remain separate, it means you can't slash them in at a high speed because they would mix. Gentle filling in process is at work, and it fills up at a rate which beats the stirring rate by digging, so that the sample in the core has protected itself from the meteoritic stirring by having overburden piled onto it fast enough. So that's a very different picture from that which has been generally discussed, because it puts very much in doubt the question of that regolith merely being the consequence of breaking up of a bedrock underneath. Another item is of the same nature. We find that in the electrical properties, and I understand again the same is true mineralogically and chemically and nuclear-wise, it is clear that the rocks seen in the Apollo 12 site would not, by grinding up, produce the fines. We observe that in terms of the electrical properties. If you took those rocks and ground them up, they would have different electrical quantities from those that we see for the fines. But I understand again that similar results are obtained from the other disciplines. So if you had a bedrock at a depth of a few feet, which is what has been discussed, then surely you would expect that the local rocks that you find in your site are predominantly those dug up from craters more than a few feet deep in your general vicinity. And you would expect, therefore, to find a predominance of the local rocks being of the same nature as the local finds. This is not the case. We have to suppose that the finds and the rocks come from somewhat different locations. They don't come from the same locality. So the locally produced regolith on the top of a shallow bedrock seems to be wrong. That seems to be the wrong picture. So all that being so, my own personal view is that one has to take very seriously, therefore, the question of what transportation processes of a gentle nature can take place over the moon's surface, because only the gentle ones that would allow the layering to persist, that could put down layers as little as a centimeter of one kind and not mix up the whole thing. And we have to discuss what mechanisms of that kind can exist on the moon. And, of course, I've always stressed that electrostatic processes are likely to achieve that, but I'm quite open-minded if anybody can produce any other processes that produce any surface cream. All that I can say is that electrostatic works, and I know it works. I know, do it in the lab. And I have done it with a lunar sample in the lab and produced a migration over the surface by perfectly reasonable electrostatic means that would occur on the moon. So I personally think that what we're seeing in the core and in the relationships between the different materials, finds and rocks, is evidence that a creep over the surface has taken place on a substantial scale.
Dr. Anders?
One of the things we did certainly bears out what Professor Gold said. Namely, we have done a chemical analysis for 15 rare elements in the double core from Apollo 12. We found that a layer about 13 centimeters below the surface was spectacularly enriched in two elements, bismuth and cadmium, by factors of almost 100,000. And yet the layers above and below this layer were not at all enriched in these two elements. So here we have a chemical marker which has persisted undisturbed for God knows how many millions of years. And our conclusion is the same as Professor Gold's, namely that whoever is in charge of the gardening on the moon is not doing a very conscientious job. Now, the main part of my talk was concerned with measurements of the same elements in lunar rocks. And what we attempted to do is to compare the three kinds of basalt of which we have samples at present from the solar system. There are terrestrial basalts, lunar basalts, and meteoritic basalts. There are several classes of meteorites which have often been called basaltic, and we have analyzed the number of those for comparison with lunar and terrestrial basalts. Now, there are two groups of elements that we have studied rather carefully and that show interesting trends. One of these are the elements that are very rare on the surface of planetary bodies which have differentiated because they like to go into the metal phase. And that includes gold, silver, platinum, and so on. We find that the reason for that is that they are presumably the gold and platinum of the Earth is mostly in the Earth's core, and therefore there is very little of it left on the surface, and hence these are precious metals. Now, on the moon, we find that the abundance of gold and silver is 100 times lower still than in either terrestrial basalts or meteoritic basalts. Now, the odd thing about that is that here we have basalts from a large body, the Earth. We have basalts from quite small bodies, asteroids, presumably at least a factor of 10 smaller than the Earth in radius. And the moon is intermediate, and yet it falls out of line. The meteoritic and terrestrial basalts are quite similar in their gold and silver content. The lunar basalts are spectacularly out of line. Now, I would point out, first of all, that this contradicts the fission hypothesis for the origin of the moon. According to the fission hypothesis, the moon and Earth were one and the same body, then the core is segregated, and then the moon was somehow spun off. In that case, if the moon is nothing but a portion of the Earth, then the silicate part of the moon should show the same pattern of these elements as the terrestrial basalts do. The fact that we find a huge difference suggests that the removal of metal from the surface of the moon and the surface of the Earth were two different processes that happened under two different sets of conditions. So that's enough to antagonize one group of my friends who believe in the fission theory. But I've also tried my best to antagonize another group that believes in the capture theory by pointing out then that the fact that the moon, that the Earth and several classes of meteorites, which most people believe come from different asteroids, that they all show essentially the same pattern, perhaps suggests that there is a standard planetary pattern of the abundance of gold, silver, platinum metals. And the fact that the moon falls out of line suggests that some special circumstance affected the moon that did not affect the other bodies. Now, you can go and look for some special process, and I think it is perhaps a significant clue that among the bodies of which we have samples, the moon is the only one which is a satellite of a planet. And maybe that is a special circumstance one is looking for, that this spectacular depletion in gold and silver has something to do with the fact that the moon is a satellite of the Earth and presumably was a long time ago. Now, we have also looked at some volatile elements where, again, the moon stands out. It's, again, roughly 100 times poorer in elements such as thallium, bismuth, and lead than are the Earth and the Eucrite meteorites. One can interpret these data in two ways. One can either say that the moon accreted at a somewhat higher temperature than the other bodies, and therefore these elements were left behind in the solar nebula to a greater degree. If one goes through this calculation, one finds that the average formation temperature for the Earth and the Eucrites is something like 390 degrees Fahrenheit, and for the moon it's 460. Now, these temperatures should really be taken with a grain of salt, because presumably these bodies formed at a time when temperatures fell in the solar nebula, and the bulk of these volatile elements came in at the tail end of accretion, when temperatures had fallen low enough for the material separating from the nebula to have its full cosmic quota of these elements. So another way of looking at our results would be to say that the Earth received a larger share of this volatile rich material than the moon did. And that is one reason, for instance, why the Earth has so much more water than the moon does. Now, again, one can ask, why is it that the moon was discriminated against to such a large degree? It's something like a factor of 100. Why is it that it was less effective in capturing this volatile rich material? We don't have a fully satisfactory answer yet, but again, I can make a hand-waving argument saying that it had something to do with the fact that the moon was near the Earth and its orbital motion around the Earth interfered with its caused it to accrete dust less efficiently. This is perhaps not a very good argument. In the absence of gas, certainly Fred Singer has shown that it does not apply in the absence of gas, but during the accretion process, gas was present, and then the situation gets complicated in such a way where one can make hand-waving arguments of this sort without being immediately shut up by one's friends. And finally, we attempted to learn a little more about the meteoritic material falling on the moon. In the Apollo 11 samples, we showed that the meteoritic material in the lunar soil was a very primitive composition, similar to carbonaceous chondrites. Now, with Apollo 12, we have had a good many more samples to work on, and we begin to see differences. Soil samples collected right on the rims of craters show meteoritic material similar to ordinary chondrites or iron meteorites, the most common classes falling on Earth as sizable objects. Then, as soon as one gets some tens of feet away from the crater, one begins to see this very primitive carbonaceous chondrite-like material. Our interpretation is that the large crater-forming objects that struck the moon, for the most part, are fairly differentiated meteorites, like irons and carbonaceous and ordinary chondrites. But at the same time, there is a steady rain of micrometeorites falling on the moon day and night, and this is mostly of carbonaceous chondrite composition. Presumably, it represents dust from disintegrated comets. The reason why this is interesting is that I think it opens up the possibility of perhaps establishing the composition first of some of the larger objects that made the Maria that have been speculated about a great deal, and second, in perhaps even the planetesimals, the building blocks that made the moon and the Earth. Especially in the highlands, there should still be some debris around from the planetesimals, the small bodies that produce the moon and the Earth. And possibly, if our chemical method works, we may be able to characterize this material when the astronauts bring back a bucket full of soil from the highlands.
Dr. Morrison?
Well, our session was mislabeled. First of all, we were listed under mineralogy and petrology, and most of the contributors to that session were geochemists. Then the subheading was major element chemistry, and while we did discuss major element chemistry, most of the people also included trace element chemistry. So, basically, our session was different from the other concurrent sessions in that we were talking more detail, geochemical detail. Now, my group study was very much similar in goal to what Professor Anders discussed, namely the elemental abundances of lunar soil, breccia, and rocks, the purpose being to use these elements, these chemical indicators, to unravel some of the previous history of these samples. The detail, of course, is tremendous. This is one of the bonuses of bringing a sample back as opposed to having some remote gadget getting marginal data on information 250 million miles away. We and the other investigators use the most sophisticated techniques, mass spectrometry, nuclear reactors, neutron activation, emission spectroscopy, microprobes, X-ray fluorescence, you name it. All of these techniques have been used by the various groups. My research group concentrated on spark source mass spectrometry and neutron activation analysis. I guess we have perhaps one of the most complete analyses. We were able to get quantitative information on 56 elements on rather small samples, a gram of material or a half a gram, when NASA was hard put to supply us some of these things. All right, now what do you learn about these things? Well, first of all, we found out that the elemental abundances of the soil and breccia, we had three soils and one precious breccia, they were similar. We're talking about looking at 56 elements, you'd have to say that compositionally they're very closely related. But they were considerably enriched in many elements over the igneous rocks. So that was a very interesting observation. Then once again, the same story that was found in the Apollo 11 materials, the volatile elements are down, Dr. Anders mentioned this, and the refractory elements are up, enriched. Then, of course, there's that very intriguing group of elements, the rare earths, from a chemical viewpoint. Once again, the negative europium anomaly was found in the Apollo 12 material, as was found in the Apollo 11. Another interesting development was the fact that there was a greater fractionation of the lighter rare earths as opposed to the heavier rare earths in the soil and breccias. This was not found in the rocks, in the igneous rocks, or in any of the Apollo 11 soil, breccia, or rocks. So what we're saying is that certain fractionation processes were at work and are being exhibited in the soil and breccia of Apollo 12. All right, so then we have the other important observation that the trace element abundances were lower in the 12 igneous rocks as compared to the 11 igneous rocks. Everybody's interested in, you know, what's new on Apollo 12 as compared to 11. So the trace elements are lower in the rocks. The opposite is true with regard to the soil and breccia. Trace elements, elemental compositions, are significantly higher in the Apollo 12 soils as compared to the Apollo 11. So what we're saying is that the Apollo 12 material and Apollo 11 material are first cousins, but by God, they're differences. They have their own individuality. Then the obvious thing that one wants to do is to compare the Apollo 12 materials with meteoritic materials, terrestrial materials. And we made a comparison with the basaltic achondrites, a type of meteorite, and that was also compared with the Apollo 11 material, and we found that of all the various kinds of materials, the Apollo 12 igneous rocks did compare. Well, there was a close similarity between the Apollo 12 igneous rocks and the basaltic achondrites. The same similarity existed with the Apollo 11 material, but the match is better now with the Apollo 12 rocks. Now, it's been suggested, well, certainly it implies some genetic relationship between the basaltic achondrites and the Apollo 12 rocks. some people have postulated that the basaltic achondrites derived from the moon, all we can really say is that their chemistry must be very similar. And once again, a comparison was made between the Apollo 12 material and the oceanic tholeites as a representative of a terrestrial basalt. And once again, there are similarities, but very significant differences. So in summary, one could say that there's an overall similarity of the material returned from the two Apollo sites, but there are significant differences to suggest detailed geochemical processes that are special to each site.
And finally is Dr. Eamon, and Dr. Eamon, by the way, spells his name E-H-M-A-N-N.
Thank you. Well, Dr. Morrison has pretty well summed up the same session that I participated in. There are a few other comments I would make. He pointed out the first cousin-type relationship between the 11 and 12 material. This seems to be the case. They're similar in many ways, but there are some differences. Among the major elements, where I had some concern, oxygen and silicon are enriched in the Apollo 12 materials as compared to the Apollo 11 materials. And that very special rock, Looney Rock 13, is very rich in both silicon and oxygen. Perhaps one of the major points I made in my paper is that there appear to be two chemical groups among the Apollo 12 crystalline rocks. These were divided into type A and type B, based mainly on the texture of these rocks. But irrespective of the texture, there seems to also be a chemical grouping among these rocks. We observe this particularly for aluminum, where the crystalline rocks in Apollo 12 seem to fall into a high aluminum group and a low aluminum group. Other speakers in the same session, Dr. Wanke and Dr. Katita, also mentioned similar groupings. Our data also shows this grouping for magnesium and for iron, and some of the other speakers noted this as well. So I think this is one of the interesting things about our session, too, that there does seem to be a chemical grouping, at least among these major elements, from our work, on the basis of the chemistry and irrespective of texture. One other thing that's of interest, of course, is that the fine material from both Apollo 11 and Apollo 12, the soil samples, in other words, are certainly very complex mixtures. You simply cannot take the two types of crystalline rocks, type A and B, and grind them up and mix them in any proportion and get the composition of the fines. This was noted, of course, on Apollo 11, and it is also true here on Apollo 12. Now, based on our aluminum abundances, which we did by 14 MeV neutron activation analysis, we determined that if you made up an admixture of, oh, say, some 17% anorthositic material, which contains an appreciable amount of aluminum, about 17% of anorthositic material, you could pretty well match the observed aluminum content of the fines. Aluminum is lower in the type A and B rocks than it is in the fines, and you have to add something else to get the aluminum, and about 17% of this material would do it. And there are a number of other admixtures of various things, including a component of carbonaceous chondrite-type material, perhaps some material similar to rock 13, which could all be added in with the A and B rocks to make the fines. And some of this material was discussed in the various talks today. Going back to some of my own work again, we determined oxygen directly in these lunar materials using this technique of 14 MeV neutron activation. Oxygen is a very difficult material to determine directly, and we can get at it directly by this technique. Oxygen is generally depleted in the lunar materials with respect to terrestrial materials. This is in part due to the fact that there's ilmenite in the lunar materials, and ilmenite is a mineral low in oxygen. But there are other differences. It turns out if you look at silicon-oxygen correlations in both the Apollo 11 and Apollo 12 materials, the silicon-oxygen correlations are different for the lunar materials than they are for rocks on Earth. And this, I think, again, is a rather important observation that we made. Apparently, the amount of oxygen that is available during the crystallization of the rocks must certainly play a part in the crystallization process and the amount of oxygen finally taken up by the rocks. And finally, one last thing. We find that oxygen is depleted in the Apollo 12 fines over that which would be required for simple stoichiometry. In other words, just adding it up chemically, the amount of oxygen that would be required to balance all the cations present. The oxygen in the fines is depleted over what you would calculate to be necessary by simple stoichiometry. And we made the suggestion that this might be due to a depletion of oxygen in these fines due to the action of solar wind hydrogen. Now, there are alternate explanations for this. This is just merely one of them. I think I'll stop at that.
Yes, sir.
I think Dr. Anders has presented a very interesting paper this morning, and he's to be complimented on his efforts to understand these exceedingly rare elements. I'd like to suggest that the model that I proposed explains the siderophile elements very easily. If you have a pool of silicates and you reduce a little iron, it will sink out, carry siderophile elements, and you reduce a little bit more and it washes out more, then a little bit more and washes it out more. It is exactly the thing that is needed to reduce the siderophile elements to a very low concentration. And I think, though I also agree that it's difficult to believe that the moon escaped from the Earth, I find this the least desirable of the models. Nevertheless, if this is a mechanism of removing this particular rock, it doesn't bear on the question. The melting of the surface of the moon might have occurred independently of the Earth. But as I say, I agree that this is the least likely, it seems to me, of processes for the production of the moon.
We're ready for questions up here in the front. Let me repeat that question for the transcript, if I can, since we didn't get it on the mic there.
Can you give us a count on how many elements practically all of them, except for the transplutonium elements?
There was one comment in our session, I believe, that platinum was probably the least well-determined element. I think somebody made that comment. But there is some platinum data.
In terms of most of the elements, it's a matter of detectability. Yeah. Some are extremely low.
Some are very low.
But I think just about everything's been accounted for.
In fact, there is no terrestrial rock at present which has been studied as thoroughly as tranquility based on Apollo 12 landing site rocks.
The hard part is to find equal data to compare the living material with.
Question back here, and then we'll come over on the other side.
So this is precisely what people are trying to find out. I think there have been these three or four principal theories, which the one most in disfavor in recent years has been that the moon is the original satellite of the Earth. But the argument is continuing, as I think the standings of these various hypotheses go up and down with time. As Professor Urey pointed out, I think the fission theory at the moment is probably at the bottom. But the question has not been settled by any means. And that's why each of us is constantly looking for some new experimental evidence that will tip the balance.
Could I make just a remark about that? If Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars each had a moon, we would be sure that it either escaped from the planet or the thing grew as a double planet. Galileo would have recognized them as all as double planets if that had been the case. And what is really curious about the moon is that it's unique. Here it is about planet Earth and the other terrestrial planets. Well, Mars has a couple little chips
the rest have nothing. And one of the most important arguments, in my mind, against escape or formation of a double planet is that it is unique. I don't see why Venus shouldn't have developed a planet too, a moon also.
No, sir. You can perfectly well argue. I don't think we ought to make this into a scientific conversation, but nevertheless, I can't stop myself at this stage to say this. We could well suppose that there was an equal tendency to make planets on satellites on all the planets. Mercury would not have it because it is too close to the sun, and its mass is very small.
Yeah.
And the planet would the satellite would have to be in a very closely defined range.
Yes.
Before it would not be whisked away by the solar perturbation. So Mercury has a much less of a chance to contain.
Quite so.
Venus spins retrograde.
Well, why?
Why does it spin retrograde?
Yes, well, I suppose the moon collided with it, as Singer has been saying.
Well, no, Singer's. Yes.
How do you get the axis tilted at 23 degrees for the Earth, 26 for Mars? Uranus tipped over at 90.
Well,
we talked about that years ago. There must be big objects around colliding to produce this.
No, but look, I'm saying that Venus would not now be expected to own a satellite because, for whatever reason, it spins retrograde, and a retrograde spinning terrestrial planet cannot own a satellite because it'll eat it up. Its tidal friction will bring it in and it will eat it up. So Mercury doesn't have one because it's too small and too close to the Sun. Venus doesn't have one because it's a spinning retrograde for whatever reason, and it would have eaten it up. The Earth has one. Mars, again, is rather small.
That's right.
And has a large perturbation from Jupiter.
That's
and
right.
Again makes it a little bit harder, considerably harder than the Earth, to own a satellite.
Well, it owns two, you see. So the perturbation from Jupiter doesn't.
Well, it owns two. No. It owns two tiny ones, terribly close to it.
But the point is, it could not
own one like the Earth. If it had a thing like the Earth, it would have escaped.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's not reasonable to say it was a very unique event that made the terrestrial satellite. It's perfectly easy to say that chance for making equal type of objects existed for all of them. But in that case, only the Earth would still own it.
Well, at the same time, Venus is a planet that's about the same size as the Earth.
No, it spins retrograde.
Not very much farther. But why was it retrograde?
Well,
why, if you have, in one retrograde. Case, a spinning mass of gas and solids that will produce a planet rotating in this direction and a satellite going around it like that, why didn't it also happen for Venus? The fact that Venus rotates in the opposite direction makes it unique also. And I think Singer's suggestion that a lunar-type object collided with it and made it rotate in the opposite direction is not an unreasonable one.
All the terrestrial planets were formed by the collision of objects that built up that planet. And they were all made from solids. They were not made from gases. And so, therefore, their spins are all over the place because it depended critically on the last few collisions as to what the piece was left, what spin it was left with. And I find nothing remarkable about the fact that they are all over the place in so far as spins go.
On the other hand, if the objects of which they accumulated out of moons, there'd have to be 80 of them to do it. And if I had 80 objects sailing around the solar system pretty much with angular momentum lying in the plane, and they just collided to give the Earth, I would think the axis might point up this way.
Not correct.
You were talking about the energy of the moonquakes. If an astronaut were walking, say, 50 feet away from the center of one of these quakes, would he notice it?
Just barely, the largest. He might feel it through his boots. It has a lot to do with the surface material, and the material that he's on favors it. But he would just barely feel it. Certainly wouldn't knock him down or anything of that sort, as many people have worried. This is not in response to a question, but a point that I did want to make.
you know that we've had informal discussions with our Russian colleagues over the last year or two, us, many of us, in particular in the case of the seismic experiment, where we know we need a network and are hopeful of achieving a good network in combination with the Russians someday. I wonder if you realize how encouraged we are today at having so distinguished a Russian visitor, and that this is not to be taken lightly. We hope very much that it means something important for our future relationships with them and data exchange of this sort, especially now that they have Lunokhod operational there and show signs of continued research. There's a great deal to be gained by encouraging this kind of thing, and this looks to me as though it may be a first step and an extremely exciting one for us.
Dr. Urey, I probably missed this, but do you have a theory for the Mascon support? You said you
Yes.
Now, what is...
My suggestion is it's a big object that made the Maria that came in at a rather low velocity and spread out down below. And you added the mass that is needed from outside, and it was good and hard and solid and supported it. But I wasn't emphasizing that this morning or this afternoon. We were... talk about other things.
Dr. Urey, what is the source, what do you suggest is the source of heating in your first, in the first melting process? In
there's several things that might be due to. Let me start them sort of in chronological order. Some years ago, I suggested that there were many lunar-type objects around the solar system. Now, people didn't like it. Didn't like it at all. I had no followers whatever. But I can make the surface of the moon hot in this way. I can cool it off slowly. I can do a lot of things with it. I finally called up a very good friend of mine who was a very expert astrophysicist and said, please, won't you look at this article and see what you think of it? He telephoned me Sunday and said, you didn't see anything wrong with the article. It was published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, which is a very good journal, and I had asked that the article be carefully reviewed and all of that, and he thought there was nothing much wrong with it. Now, if you have a great big gas sphere, you can heat up the center. You can keep it cold, and you can accumulate the moon cold in the center of this, and then you radiate energy into space. It contracts and it gets hot at the center, and I can heat up the surface very easily. This is one way. But a magnetic field sweeping over an object that is somewhat hot will generate heat. And we believe that the angular momentum of the sun was lost by this sort of a process. Also, if the moon was caught by tidal action, it will heat up the moon to some extent. And perhaps this was in the outer part of the moon that this occurred. Numerous things of this sort. A hot sun doesn't appeal to me much because it would heat the surface and then you'd have a liquid surface and you couldn't heat much deeper. But a variety of these things may all have cooperated to produce the effect that I talked about.
So do we have another question? Zach?
Dr. Gold, would you explain this electrostatic process of transportation that created these striations a little bit so we might understand it?
Yes, in fact, I have a beautiful picture here of what can be done in the lab. The point is that if a surface of small particles is bombarded by electrons in a certain energy range, the detailed reason for that is would take me too far to explain, but it is understood. In an energy range, it happens to be between about 200 and 800 volts. Then the grains of that surface become very differently charged in a rather arbitrary way. Some grains get charged 600 volts different from their neighbors. At other bombarding voltages, it is not so. They get all charged the same. At much lower or much higher voltages, they all charge alike. But in this particular energy range, some get charged one way and some the other. The system tears itself apart internally for the sign of charge that it receives. And the result is that the grains are violently agitated. It's a beautiful thing to behold in the lab when you do it, because you make a little dust storm on it that crawls and crawls, sometimes uphill, sometimes downhill, in most spectacular ways. On an average downhill, on average to clean off surfaces and to settle everything down below, flat. Now, I'm particularly intrigued about the fact that electrostatic migration would be a gentle way of moving materials so that I could maintain such layers as we've heard undoubtedly exist in the core. And another point, that you have all seen pictures of the front of the moon and the back of the moon, I trust, and have seen that the two look dramatically different, the front and the back of the moon. You know, the front of the moon is all full of Mare ground, and the back of the moon is all full of Highland ground. And there's a huge difference, difficult to account for just on statistical chance basis. My view now is that the reason for that difference is electrostatic migration having been responsible for flattening out the ground on the near side, because electrons in this energy range are specifically present in the what's called the magnetic tail of the Earth. And every month, for about 4 days, the moon goes through this tail of the Earth and gets treated by the magnetic tail electrons in that energy range. In the free solar streams, free solar wind, when the moon is outside all this, it does not receive any such electrons from the sun. The sun does not give out electrons at energy range. So, therefore, presumably the side facing the Earth gets such a treatment for 4 days each month in the right energy range and would facilitate electrostatic transportation and therefore tend to make the filling in of low ground flat. The back of the moon does not have a similar treatment. And I take it that that's a good explanation why the front is so different from the back.
Well, Tommy, you have to make some differences in chemical composition, too.
Right.
And chemical compositions are not easily changed.
Why not?
Well, there's titaniferous basalt in the smooth areas on this side of the moon, and so far as we know, it's anorthosite that's in the mountains.
You don't know anything about the mountains. You've never been.
No.
What do you know about the mountains being anorthosite?
Sure.
A follow-up on that, if I can. Does that mean you think then perhaps the fines came from the dark side of the moon? Does that explain the difference in the fines?
There is no dark side. Let's get that fact clear first. There's a front and a back to the moon. There's not a dark side and a light side.
There's a difference in chemical composition, Tommy.
Yeah, I know that.
You can't make titaniferous basalt out of anorthosite.
I don't know what's on the highlands, Harold. If we go to the highlands
and
look...
We've had several analyses.
From the highlands on which we have not been?
Oh, we have been.
Well, who's been on the highlands?
Kirkovich sent instruments to the highlands, and we got an analysis.
They don't prove this anorthosite.
I'm sure they do.
But in any case,
I think your chemical friends will all disagree with you on that. Now, I think that you have a very good idea. I think you have a very good idea about the movement of this.
You are telling me that no material can have filled the lowlands from the highlands because you know that all the highlands are of such a chemical composition as would not fit that sample I've got?
Some of the highlands in the smooth area of this side.
I've got different chemistry in every few centimeters in that core 40 centimeters deep in that particular location. I'll no doubt have equally different chemistry in all other such cores that I could take. So obviously I have material deposited from all kinds of different places.
Come on,
but
fellas.
Excuse me, I want to respond though to your question, so will you say it again?
Do you think the fines then are a result of
from the back of the moon? Just from higher ground, from whatever higher ground there may have been now or in the past in some vicinity of of that site. Which may be the highlands. But maybe some other high ground.
I agree. But it's the smooth areas down here at the bottom that were formed not completely level, and you moved it from the higher parts of the Maria down into the lower parts of the Maria. You don't move it from the mountain surface. That's all.
Ed DeLong, and then we'll have time for one more.
Another one for you, Dr. Gold. Are you saying then that for 4 days out of the month, the moon is subjected to the correct electron voltage to cause this migration? Would that mean then that during this period you would have fairly rapid movement? I mean, would you have this dust storm effect that you have described in the laboratory model?
No. Look, the rate of transportation and deposition that would fashion the moon, even if you made, as I want to say, the whole filling of the mare is 4 kilometers in 4 billion years. That is 10,000 years to put down 1 centimeter. When I do this stuff in the lab, I do 1 centimeter in 10 minutes. So it's a very different thing, 10 minutes to 10,000 years.
What's the difference in the rate?
Oh, well, I put a very much bigger electron flux down, of course, in the lab, because I'm not prepared to hang around for that 10,000 years.
Right here.
I'm most intrigued about Dr. Gold's theory to explain the difference between far and near side of the moon. Could one of you tell me what other possible theories there are that might explain it?
Any takers?
Yeah, the gravitational interaction is one, at a time when the moon was much closer to the Earth, and now second-order terms in the gravitational field become important. And you could have, in a sense, pulled liquid into great cavities formed by impact at that stage. And I think you would have to assume in that case that already the moon was locked into an orbit in which it did not rotate relative to the Earth. That is, that it already kept one side to the Earth, and that's a little bit of a problem. But that would quickly happen. And although I'm not saying that I have evidence to favor that mechanism, that is one possibility that's been suggested.
May I make a remark on this? First of all, I wish to emphasize that for years I have felt that Tommy's suggestion of the movement of material of this kind on the moon to a limited extent was a very valuable suggestion. I've defended it for 10 years that way. I am not objecting to what he says, except that for the extreme end of it. Now, let me point out that in order to get this stuff that we see in the smooth areas of the moon, we've had to have a melting process below the surface of the moon. And according to the model which I and my colleagues have been working on, the amount of energy available to do this is marginal. It just barely does it. Now, if you can think of any way by which the backside of the moon doesn't get quite as hot as the front side, then maybe it won't happen on the backside. And I have suggested to my colleagues, and I don't know how seriously to take it either, just like you, that possibly the moon, when it was traveling freely away from the Earth around the sun, was oriented with one tine toward the sun. And the face now facing toward the Earth was facing the sun. As a result of this, it was about 300 degrees higher than the backside. And hence, the melting process would be more favorable on the backside, on that side, and would transfer titaniferous material to the surface. Now, if you ask me if I'm firm that I believe this is the case, no, not at all. But this is another idea.
What would the buoyancy do? Well, tidal drag is so little. To arrest the spin of the moon by tidal friction to become sun-facing is, you know, it takes much more than geologic time.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, I think with that we'll terminate.
But the fact of the case is that we don't know why it is.